Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Connolly, Judge Smith, the Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is June 5th, 2024. Today's argument will be live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. The audio record for today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. So as a reminder to all those in the audience, there are no other recordings permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. Today we have five cases on our calendar with two set for oral argument this morning. The first case is Edrington v. Sheridan. Please correct me if I've pronounce the names incorrectly. Case number A23-1782. Good morning, counsel. As I know that you're all aware, you will each be given 15 minutes for your oral argument this morning, and appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you could please, at the beginning, before beginning your argument, identify yourself and your client for the audio record. With that, counsel for appellants, if you're ready to proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Erica Holzer, and I represent the appellants, Juliana and Catherine Sheridan, the two parents of AJS. This is and should have been, in the district court, a straightforward case. The legislature has unambiguously provided that when a person donates their sperm or eggs to recipient parents for use in assisted reproduction, that person is barred from claiming to be the resulting child's biological or legal parent. Now, this is, of course, very good policy. When a couple needs to use assisted reproduction, as many Minnesota families have had to do, the Minnesota Parentage Act makes it clear who is and who is not a parent to that resulting child. If the recipient parents are married, as is the case here, the Minnesota Parentage Act provides that the birth mother and her spouse are the child's two parents, and the donor of genetic material is expressly precluded from claiming to be the child's biological or legal parent. Now, we are here appealing a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, and there are not many family law cases that come to this court on a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, but it is imperative this court confirm that the law means what it says, that if a sperm donor or an egg donor brings a claim trying to assert parentage over a child who was created using their donated gametes, their parentage claim will be dismissed. There are three issues.
In all circumstances.
Yes.
So let's take a look at this hypothetical. Let's assume it's the same facts as we have here with one difference. Well, two differences, I guess. Your two clients get divorced. And then for whatever reason, I hope I pronounced it correctly, Ms. Kuhl's client becomes romantically involved with the birthing mother. They don't get married. No one adopts anybody. And is now living with the birthing mother. And then decides that he does want to be recognized now as the father. And the non-birthing mother objects. Why would we want to foreclose the opportunity of this statute in those, albeit unique, circumstances?
Thanks, Your Honor. I think that to make it clear, there would be a path to parentage for that man in that scenario.
And but
that...
not using a blood test. Because
correct.
You couldn't use the blood test, right? I mean, your position is, if it's, you can never use the blood test or genetic test for a sperm donor.
Correct.
Would that be a fair statement?
Correct. And
so in that path, he would be foreclosed.
Correct. And there would be no need for a genetic test, Your Honor, if the person donated their gametes, because in all cases, when a person donates their gametes, they are necessarily genetically related to the resulting child. So not only is it not necessary, but it's precluded. And there is a pathway for parentage in that case, and that would be through Chapter 5, 259. So it would not...
He would be holding his home out and recognizing that he is a father.
No, Your Honor, it would be through the Minnesota adoption statute. So the legislature very well.
But he doesn't, under my scenario, there is no adoption.
Well, the.
Under this scenario and that scenario, for whatever reason, he doesn't want to adopt.
Well, in that scenario, Your Honor, then.
Because I suppose in his scenario, he is the father. Why would I want to adopt my own child if I'm the father?
Well, a couple answers to your question, Your Honor. First is he's expressly precluded from claiming to be the biological or legal parent under the Minnesota Parentage Act. He's not barred from later trying to be declared a legal parent under the adoption statutes. Another point is that the Minnesota Parentage Act only permits two legal parents, only two. So in a situation where a child is born via sexual reproduction, the Minnesota Parentage Act provides a whole scheme to weigh competing presumptions and determine which two should be declared the legal parent. In the situation where a child is born via assisted reproduction, the legislature very wisely has determined that parentage should be determined differently. That because when donated gametes are used, the sperm donor or the egg donor is always going to be biologically or genetically related to the child, and the legislature has determined it is never in the child's best interest in the presumptive fashion for that person to be declared a legal parent. That person is expressly barred from using the Minnesota Parentage Act to become a parent. They can become a parent through Chapter 259, which is the adoption statutes, and that does happen. There are situations where there are three legal parents currently in Minnesota. That has only ever happened, as far as we are aware, under Chapter 259. Respondents do not cite any case, and we are aware of no case in which any court, other than the district court in this case, has held that there is a possibility for three legal parents under the Minnesota Parentage Act.
But what about the situation where the parents contract, say, I want to be the father, I'm going to donate sperm, we're contracting, I'm going to be the father.
So you've got a sperm donor,
yep,
and a two married lesbian women,
yep,
and all three want to be parents.
Yep.
Then in that case, the birth mother is declared the biological mother under the Parentage Act. The birth mother's spouse, whether she's married to a man or a woman, is declared the other parent for the child. And if the if all the parties agree that that is the intent, that they want to have three legal parents in this situation, then the only mechanism currently under Minnesota statutes is to provide legal parentage. The pathway for that man is through Chapter 259.
Okay, so you're saying that they could never contract without going through an adoption process?
Correct. And that happens all the time, Your Honor. Before marriage equality was passed, lesbian couples were having kids, and there was no presumption available to the birth mother to the spouse of the birth mother, because marriage equality wasn't recognized. And so the partner of the birth mother would regularly both of those parents in that situation would regularly undergo an adoption in order to solidify and declare their legal rights. It happened for years before marriage equality passed. I'd like to go back for a moment to whether or not respondent has standing to compel genetic testing. Appellants simply asked this court to apply the plain
language. Kind of a moot point if everybody agrees that he's the sperm donor. I mean, it seems like it's moot.
Well, it's not moot because respondents have kept it live on appeal. And to answer your question, though, in effect, it's not necessary, if that's what you're getting at, Your Honor, because In all cases, like I said, when a sperm donor or an egg donor donates their genetic material, they are necessarily going to be related to the resulting child. And that's why in subdivision 5C of the genetic testing statute, the legislature wisely concluded that not only is genetic testing not permitted, but a sperm donor or an egg donor in those scenarios cannot use the genetic presumption or any other presumption in the Minnesota Parentage Act in order to be declared a legal parent.
The district court seemed to place a lot of stock on the other provision dealing with artificial insemination, doctor-assisted. Why is that wrong?
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. The first is that Section 257.62, Subdivision 5C, is not ambiguous. The courts can only look outside the plain language of a statute if the court first determines that the statute on its four corners is unambiguous. The court never concluded that it was ambiguous, and I don't believe respondents are arguing that the statute is ambiguous. Second, Subdivision 257.56 just simply doesn't apply. It applies to a set of facts that are not present here. And so appellants didn't argue that it applied below. Respondents didn't argue that it applied below. It was the district court that decided that, not that Subdivision 5C doesn't apply, but that Subdivision 5C is limited by one of those five factors in 257.56, which is the physician requirement. It ignored the other four factual predicates and sort of plucked that one out of Section 5.6 and put it into Subdivision 5C. Our statutes our canons of statutory interpretation preclude the court from doing that. It contradicts the plain language of the statute, and it contradicts the manifest intent of the legislature. The legislature determined that children born via assisted reproduction, the parentage of those children should be determined in a fashion that's different than children born via sexual reproduction.
Doesn't 5.6, I mean, I guess my reading of 5.6 is that it really only applies to the donation of sperm, when 5C is pretty clear that it also would apply to situations not contemplated by 5.6, including the donation of an egg.
Correct. So what sort of the legislative history, if the court wants to reach that, if it concludes that the statute is ambiguous, 257.56 was enacted in 1980 when assisted reproduction was just sort of becoming more commonplace, and the legislature at that time wisely determined that the donor of sperm cannot claim to be a legal parent and that the parents are instead the married couple who are using that donated sperm. In 2006, when more types of assisted reproduction were available, such as IVF and at-home artificial insemination, and egg donation and other types of gamete donation were medically possible, the legislature expanded that same policy by enacting Subdivision 5C.
Can I ask a question about, this is what I find complicated about Subdivision 5C. And I assume that your answer is going to be that our interpretation of Subdivision 1 is what fixes the problem. But Subdivision 5C says a determination under this subdivision and then has this neither nor provision.
Yes.
And it's confusing to me because that would seem to indicate that you could get the genetic testing, that you could have the child have the genetic testing, but then there wouldn't be any use for that genetic testing. What's your argument with regard to interpreting that clause in this context?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is that it would be absurd. And this court cannot conclude that the legislature would intend absurd results. For the legislature to allow the invasiveness of a compelled genetic test and then not allow the person to use that test to claim biological or legal parentage, that would be an absurd result. And the court has to construe the statutes to avoid that type of result.
And this statute really does only apply to the parentage question, right? Are there circumstances where one might want to get where one could use this genetic test for any other purpose other than parentage under this statute? Sorry, I know I interrupted your one too. But
the purpose of the genetic test in subdivision 257.62 is to establish biological and then legal parentage. That's the only purpose for subdivision one.
And so if you wanted DNA testing for some other purpose, this would not be the mechanism that you would use.
You could go to the doctor. If for some reason a heterosexual married couple wanted to using assisted reproduction, either using donated sperm or the man's sperm, the husband's sperm, if they for some reason wanted to get genetic testing to confirm whose genetics are whom, they are the parents. They could just go to the doctor and get that. They wouldn't need to use 257.62 subdivision 1.
What if the sperm donor wanted genetic testing to see if the child was compatible for a kidney transplant?
And I missed the first part of your, who was?
What if, same facts here.
Yep.
And I think Judge Larson points out a good point, which is, well, if you can't use it for the presumption, why on earth would you want to test?
And yes.
My hypothesis is the sperm donor wants a test to see if the child is compatible for him as a kidney donor.
I see. This would not be the vehicle for that. You would have to get... No. Well, because the purpose of 257.62 is to determine the biological father of a child born via assisted reproduction. So before 257.62 was enacted in 1980, the genetic presumption used to be in subdivision 5.5. The legislature then pulled out genetic testing when medical advancements allowed for genetic testing to be more available, and determined a different scheme for determining parentage using genetic testing. But it was always to create a presumption of biological parentage to then lead to legal parentage. It was never for any other purpose. It was never intended for any other purpose. I see that my time is out, so I will reserve the rest of my time, which I don't have for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Counsel for respondent. And I should have said this at the beginning. Feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort.
For once, we're the same height.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often. All right.
Well, make it go up and down anyway.
Should I? Should I just move it a little bit? Make us all feel better?
It costs $300,000.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondent, William Edrington, whose preferred name is Chris. Appellant's framing of this case is not accurate and distracts from the issues at hand. I mean, at this stage, as the court knows, the facts must be taken in the light most favorable to respondent, which are that he wanted to be a father and had no significant other, so he agreed to have a child with appellants, on the condition that he be a significant part of this child's life, and the parties basically operated that way for several years.
But doesn't his pleading sort of acknowledge that he knew that he was being a donor and not that he was going to be the legal father? I mean, even taking the pleadings in the light most favorable to your client, I think the argument of appellants is that by repeatedly using the word donor, he's acknowledging that this was not a situation where they had agreed orally or contractually that they were going to be a three-parent family as opposed to a two-parent family with him having a significant relationship with the child.
So I think what's happening is that appellants are grafting a definition onto the word donor that he was not using. He was using donor in the colloquial sense of anybody.
Well, who cares what he wanted? Define donor. The statute defines donor, does it not, Ms. Kuhl?
Statute does not define donor.
Well, does it define who gets to get the benefit of these tests for parentage presumptions?
It states, it uses the term donor, but it never defines it in the statute.
Well, following up on Judge Smith's excellent point, there's no dispute, or am I correct in saying, Ms. Kuhl, there doesn't seem to be a dispute that he is the one and only source of the sperm in this couple's relationship, correct?
I believe so, as far as we know.
Okay. So then why do you want the test?
I think there's a number of reasons for tests.
Does one of them include getting the benefit of the parental presumption?
We've not argued that, but getting the tests is important because Subdivision 5C doesn't preclude other ways of establishing parentage. So you might want to get the tests to confirm that this is his child, as we think it is, to, you know, affect whether you want to pursue a different way, such as the holding out and receiving into your home.
Well, you have to have, I mean, would it be a fair statement that you need the test for that parental presumption in order to get the other parental presumption in terms of holding out in the home, right?
No.
You don't need both?
No, Subdivision 5C does not in any way preclude him from bringing an action based only on holding out and receiving it to his home. There's nothing in Subdivision 5C that says it. It says you can't use a determination under that subdivision of the genetic relation, but it doesn't say you can't use other means of establishing a parentage. And so
okay, so why do you want the test? I mean, if you don't need it, I guess I'm having trouble understanding why you want the test if everyone agrees, you know, this was the only source of the sperm, you know, that made the woman pregnant. I guess I don't know why we're doing the test. If what is the purpose of doing the test then?
Well, as far as he knows, he's the only source of sperm. Of course, he can't know who else she's come in contact with. But regardless, under the statute, he's entitled to a test. I don't think it's necessary to go the route of the test. The court could resolve this case just on the holding out and receiving into your home provision without requiring a test. But if
a party concedes that he's a sperm donor, why have a test? I mean, that seems unnecessary.
It may be unnecessary, but it's allowed and required by the statute when he's requested it.
Requested by whom?
Requested by a man alleging to be the father, as long as he alleges that there was or was not sexual contact requisite to creating a child.
Speaking of sexual contact, where is the sexual contact?
Well, there's a number of different ways that the court can interpret this statute. I think one way we suggested is that sex touching of the woman's body with his semen is sexual contact.
But he never did that. He never touched her.
But his semen touched her body. But
that's not sexual contact.
But again, even if the court thinks that's not sexual contact, the statute allows whether there was or was not sexual contact. And so the district court correctly concluded that his allegations that there was not sexual contact are sufficient under the statute.
Well, this is my question. I feel like there's been a lot of debate about the meaning of the word sexual contact. But I think if we just take out the dictionary and look at the word contact, contact is defined as physical touching. And I don't think that your client has made any allegations that he in any way has physically touch the biological mother of this child, correct?
Well, there's physical touching between his semen and her.
But he isn't his semen. I mean, what you're asking us to interpret is that his semen, once he leaves his body, is still him. And so his semen touching her is enough for physical contact. And I'm not sure what case law or body of law that we have that something that once it leaves my body and then touches some, right, like there's some intervening period of time. I guess what case law or dictionary or what body of law would you point to that there isn't sort of that actual physical contact required?
Well, we've cited the definition under the criminal code, but again, it doesn't matter if the court thinks this is not sexual contact. That's one of many ways that the court could resolve this case. But again, the statute allows genetic testing, whether there was or was not sexual contact. And the requisite.
Well, I understand your argument that the legislature has drafted this a bit differently than the Uniform Code. But I do think that in terms of the way that this was drafted, it does seem like the... Do you think it's the father is you're alleging sexual contact and I don't think I'm the father would go with there was no sexual contact. And it does seem a bit of a strained reading to me to say that you can say I am the father, but there was no requisite sexual contact just based on the way that it's drafted. Why am I wrong about that?
Yeah, not at all. I think that the legislator intentionally drafted this broadly, and there's a lot of reasons why. Somebody could say, yes, we did have intercourse, but I have some medical reason to believe I'm not the father. So that would be the reverse, someone denying paternity despite intercourse. And you could have someone here who says, you know, we didn't have sexual contact, but I have a good reason, a really good reason to believe that I am the biological father. And so the affidavit requirement
The second one, explain that again to me.
So the first...
We didn't have sexual contact, but I have a good reason to believe I'm the biological father.
Yeah, that would be the circumstances here. If the court finds that this at-home process was not sexual contact, then despite the lack of sexual contact, there's a pretty good reason to believe that he is the biological father of this child because his semen was inserted into the mother's vagina. So
I'd like to shift to the sort of the other parental presumption dealing with openly holding out the child and receiving into the home. You know, obviously, the Larson case has some favorable language to you, you know, flexibility, although... you know, there's flexibility and then there's bending something over till it almost breaks. I think those are two different concepts. But, you know, what I, in looking at the Larson case, what I thought the court was trying to do was, you know, at the end of the day, dad was, you know, spending a lot of time because of his drug addiction in a halfway house. That's not this case, right?
Larson is different factually than this case, but what it said in its reasoning applies to this case and is binding. I mean, it's a published decision, and it says that actual receipt into your home is not even necessary. It could be constructive receipt. It doesn't have to be a certain number of overnights. It's to the extent possible under the circumstances, considering whether they've been denied parenting time by the other parents.
Well, you know, okay, fair enough. So... under the circumstances, I mean, there was nothing. Is there anything in the record that would indicate that they were barring him from having the child come to their home any night?
I think he does allege that they began to restrict his time. But I also think that on a Rule 12.
From day one?
No, from day one, they were bringing the child to his
house. No, I mean, what I'm trying to find out, is there anything in the record, you know, again, Larson seemed to be, well, he couldn't have the kid with him sometimes because, you know, he was in rehab. And, you know, you can do many things in rehab, but you can't have your kid with you for a variety of reasons. So they were trying to, well, again, I can only read it from what I read it. My colleagues may read it differently. But so it's like, well, he couldn't have the kid with him all the time, and that's because he was in rehab. But he did have the kid with him sometimes. So there was a reason he couldn't have the kid with him all the time. And what I'm trying to find out is, was there some reason that from the birth of the child, I mean, as I understand the record, he was babysitting at their house sometimes. He was visiting the child at his house, at their house sometimes. But I didn't see anything that said from the parents that, But we're going to make sure you never have the kid at your home because we know what would happen then, you know, because we've looked at the statute and, you know, we've lawyered up too. I mean, there's nothing, no indication in that, is there?
I think the record is that anytime they offered him to have time with the child, he had time. I mean, I think the circumstances.
But at their am I correct in saying at their house?
No, he had the child at his own house often. He had a crib at his house. He had clothes. He had breast milk in his freezer. All of the things that you would expect for a parent to have at their house, he had. And so...
While he was babysitting.
While he was exercising parenting time.
Well, good for you for zealously representing your client and correcting me.
I also want to say there's nothing in the statute that precludes recognition of three parents. Appellants have not cited anything in any of the statutes that precludes the recognition of three parents.
But do you disagree with appellants that there aren't any case law examples where the Parentage Act has been used to establish three?
I don't
parents by presumption. Like I think that the argument that they're trying to make is that under the Parentage Act, they're creating a presumption as to two parents, and because here we have two parents that are married, that's a strong presumption that we have in the law, and we've created a lot of hurdles to invading that marriage relationship with respect to children, and that's why we have all of these hurdles you have to overcome. Do you have an example of a case outside of this context where the Parentage Act has resulted in three presumptive parents?
I don't believe this has ever occurred, but that doesn't mean it can't. I mean, we're looking at the language of the statute, and nothing precludes it when there are three people who meet the presumptions under the act. And I should say, too, that was not their argument in the motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss was based on the fact that they didn't think he met the require, or he was excluded under subdivision 5C. It wasn't there wasn't an argument about whether three parents are allowed under Minnesota law.
Let's say your client changed his mind and decided he didn't want to be a parent. What obligations would he have to the child?
If the mothers wanted him, right?
He decided he didn't want to be a father anymore. What but obligations would he have?
He does have obligations, whether he wants to or not. The mothers could move for child support. He has an obligation to support this child because he could be a presumptive parent, but that requires, the facts are that he's receiving this child into his home and holding it out as his own, that creates obligations on him, and he's fully willing to accept those obligations.
So you're saying that he couldn't just walk away now?
No. Because that's not what the parties agreed to. The parties agreed that he would be a parent to this child.
Is there a written contract of any kind?
No, but you have to accept the allegations in the complaint that was the intent, that was that he agreed to this arrangement because he wanted to be a father and he had no significant other, and he did it on condition that he be.
Pleading, though, what he said is that he didn't want to be an anonymous donor. It didn't say that he wanted to be a father. It's
in his affidavit at, I believe it's paragraph 10, he says he wanted to be a father but didn't have a significant other, and that's why he agreed to this. So not allowing him to proceed with the paternity action would be contrary to the premise on which he agreed to do this.
I know your time is running out, so please feel free to answer my question, but I do have a question. I also gave this to appellants with regard to this neither nor issue in subdivision 5C. So and here's my question. So if we agreed with you on subdivision 5A that he could get a genetic test, but we disagreed with you with respect to 5C that he then could use that in some way to establish parentage, why isn't that an absurd reading of the statute to subject a child to genetic testing in a world where that could open up a five-year-old child to issues related to getting health insurance in the future, life insurance in the future? Why isn't it an absurd result to subject the child to genetic testing if we think that under 5C he couldn't then use that test to establish parentage?
Because you want testing to make sure that he is biologically connected so that he can decide whether to pursue other means of establishing paternity, such as receiving into the home and holding out as one's own. If, for example, he got the genetic test and it showed, contrary to everybody's expectation, that perhaps she was impregnated by somebody else, then he might say, well, I don't want to pursue my paternity.
But doesn't the
action.
Genetic testing provision just apply to this mechanism of establishing parentage? I mean, this is my question, right? Is the purpose of this statute is to establish parentage, no one is disputing that he supplied the sperm in this case. If we agree with the interpretation of 5C that he cannot then use any genetic test under this statute to establish that he's the biological, or he cannot use the test itself to establish that, then why isn't it an absurd reading of the statute to subject a child to testing that he can't use to establish parentage?
Well, genetic test result is not some intrusive result. It's a quick test.
Well, it's about protecting the privacy of a child's most private information, which is their genetic sequence. So, for example, if you fill out a life insurance policy now, they say, have you ever had a genetic test? And here's the waiver for you to sign so that I, the life insurance company, can look at your genetic test to determine how much insurance I'm going to insure you for. And so we are talking about an invasive process of subjecting a five-year-old who doesn't have control over what's going to happen legally in the future to their ability to get insurance and things like that to a genetic test that they are then going to have to disclose in the future. And so I guess I'm troubled by this concept that we would subject a five-year-old to, I understand taking the test is not challenging, but that a private company in the court system having that data is challenging. Why isn't it absurd to subject a child to that if they can't use that information to get parentage?
Well, those sound like policy reasons that the legislator should weigh. And the statute says that shall be granted testing if he meets the requirements, and he does meet the requirements. And it's not absurd because there's a lot of reasons why somebody might want genetic testing to understand who is and who is not related to them. And so that's what we're left with.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
One prerequisite to the genetic testing is the sexual contact, right?
Was or was not sexual contact. So no, it's not a prerequisite.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Five quick points to make, Your Honor. First, it's important to recognize that respondents have conceded they are not claiming parentage under the genetic presumption. Second, they concede that 5C applies to this case. Third, to answer the question from Judge Smith, the Minnesota Parentage Act, when it enacted subdivision 5C and similar statutes to determine parentage of kids born via assisted reproduction, its intent was to protect both the families from a third party invading the sanctity of their family and their marriage, and the trauma that would result if a child would have to be taken from the only two parents they've ever known and being and forced to spend parenting time with a third party. It also protects sperm donors. Because if a person donates their genetic material, the legislature has wisely provided that the recipient parents, who undisputably in this case are the appellants, cannot go after the sperm donor for child support. So it's protective in both directions. Fourth, I do want to talk about the holding out presumption because...
I agree with all of that. But then... You know, what about this case where, according to Ms. Kuhl, he, and again, reading it in most light favorable to her client, you know, his intent was always to kind of be part of the family.
I would.
And you know, and I guess that was very important to him, and he didn't want to be an anonymous donor, and he does have the crib, and he is giving the toys at Christmas time, and I think I read the record, you know, when he went to Florida with your clients. I mean, what is he just toast because that's, you know, tough?
Appellants dispute some of those facts. Okay. But assuming they're true for purposes of this motion, I totally agree.
That's not your problem. That's
just for the record, we do dispute that. But assuming they are true for this purpose, the legislature has determined that the donor of genetic material is precluded, is not allowed, is the way that the legislature has stated, is not allowed to claim biological or legal parentage. And so That's one point. The other point, Your Honor, is I would urge you to go to the pleadings. Nowhere in his pleadings does he ever allege, because he can't, that the parties all agreed that he would be a parent. He doesn't allege that because it's not true. I want to talk about the holding out presumption, because subdivision 5C actually precludes respondent from asserting parentage under the holding out presumption, as the court held in the NSV case, which we cite in our briefs. In that case, the court held that a person who cannot claim to be biologically related to a child cannot establish legal parentage under the holding out presumption. So in this case, the legislature has determined that, notwithstanding the admitted genetic relationship between the sperm donor and the child, that sperm donor cannot use the genetic relationship in order to establish legal parentage, and NSV supports that conclusion. Second, the respondent admits that AJS already has two legal parents and he wants to be declared the third legal parent under the Minnesota Parentage Act. That is not permitted under the Minnesota Parentage Act. If the legislature had wanted to create more than two parents under the Parentage Act, it could do so, like California has, like Maine has, like Washington has, like the most recent Uniform Parentage Act has. Those three states and the most recent Uniform Parentage Act have held in the Parentage Act that when it's in the child's best interest, more than two parents can be declared parents. Minnesota has not done so. The La Chapelle case actually cuts against respondent's position, because in that case, nowhere in La Chapelle did the court indicate that there could be three legal parents, and I'm glad respondent admitted that at argument today. But the court actually went further and said that it expressly rejected the notion that it was creating a triumvirate parenting scheme where there even could be three legal parents. Finally, the Minnesota Parentage Act itself precludes the notion that there can be more than two legal parents. In 257.5.2, it says there are two relationships, a mother-child and a father-child. When marriage equality was passed, the legislature passed Section 517.201, which said that the statutes have to be construed in a gender-neutral manner. If I may finish.
Yeah.
What that means is that the legislature recognizes a mother-child relationship and a mother-child relationship.
Well, I had a question about this, because the district court made a finding that I guess I found confusing, and that finding was Chris's paternity action would likely be barred if, after the child's birth, appellants had initiated a Section 257.57 Subdivision 1A action to declare the mother-child relationship. But that isn't required anymore under existing law, correct?
Correct. Okay. And there are lots of parents in Minnesota who have used sperm donors that are waiting to hear what this court is going to say about that, because never before has a court ever concluded that, for example, a father has to adopt their own child or has to get a affirmative determination of parentage when the couple has to use assisted reproduction. If I may, just two other provisions.
You know, so, before you get to that, you said the NSB case?
NSV.
NSV?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's cited in both of our briefs. Section 257.54 states the biological mother and the biological father and an adoptive parent. Again, two legal parents. And then finally, 257.55 subdivision 2 says expressly, if there are more than two parents that are trying to declare parentage, it is the court's job to weigh those competing presumptions and conclude which of the two are the child's legal parents, and the third party who's attempting to create parentage under the Minnesota Parentage Act is not only not declared a parent, but they aren't entitled to parenting time, custody, custody. And then finally, if the court reaches the merits of the holding out argument, we would submit that the allegations in the complaint are, as a matter of law, insufficient. The types of allegations are no different than a babysitter, a grandparent, an aunt, a neighbor. If the Minnesota legislature intended anything, it was to protect nuclear families from a third party like respondent disrupting their lives in this manner, that he can come to the courthouse, but he will be dismissed at the Rule 12 stage. So we would urge this court to...
If we agreed with you, would we have to overrule Larson?
No, Your Honor. Larson was a case involving sexual reproduction. It's fundamentally different when there is a child born via sexual reproduction and the biological or the alleged biological father comes into the picture, even 16 years down the road, he has standing to assert parentage. The legislature has determined that in that case, genetics is a factor that the court can consider and weigh that presumption against, for example, the woman's husband if she's married. That does not apply to children born via assisted reproduction. We would urge the court not only to reverse, but to reverse and remand with instructions to dismiss this case with prejudice. There was a very concerning statement in the letter to the court about future cases. We would ask the court to protect this family as the Minnesota legislature has allowed for courts to do, to protect families like appellants from the invasion of a third party seeking to disrupt their nuclear family. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter in the time prescribed by statute.